Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The 2011 World Series has been decided, and the winner is... Hey, you didn't think I'd give up that information that easily, did you? Ahead in Only a Game, a fall classic wrap-up. Also, the Houston Astros and their fans prepare for a possible leap to the American League and the latest in the NCAA Football Conference realignment. Also coming up, Jeff Perlman's controversial new biography of Hall of Fame running back Walter Payton.
Everyone expects his sweetness, his image of you. Your sweetness, he's sweetness, this guy's sweetness. Everyone wants autographs and smiles, and they don't want to know the hurt that's going on. And he was really, really, really hurting.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Despite optimism on both sides late this week, the NBA players and owners have been unable to reach an agreement. No more meetings are scheduled, and yesterday evening, Commissioner David Stern canceled games through November 30th and announced that it would be impossible to stage a full season. Major League Baseball, on the other hand, has just finished staging a season as full as it could be. In Game 7 of the World Series last night in St. Louis, the Cardinals beat the Texas Rangers 6-2 to become baseball's champions. ESPN's Tim Kirkchian was at last night's game, and he joins me now on the line from the airport in St. Louis to wrap up the 2011 World Series. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Bill. I'm really tired, but I'm fulfilled. I saw a great World Series.
Almost nobody thought St. Louis would even make it into the playoffs, much less win it all. What qualities allowed the Cardinals to get all the way to the World Series and then earn their 11th title?
Well, I'll tell you, that is a real gritty team right there. Their ability to bounce back, their resiliency is the biggest reason they are here. They were 10.5 games back in late August. They were 8.5 games back in September. And they not only made it to the playoffs, which was a miracle, they were heavily underdogs against the Phillies, and they beat them. They were underdogs against the Brewers. They beat them. And then they beat the Texas Rangers. And not only that, Bill, but in Game 6, they were the biggest underdogs I've ever seen late in that game. They had no chance to win that game. But typical of the Cardinals, they refused to give up, and they kept on fighting, and that's why they won. I'm not sure I've seen a team make a more improbable run through the World Series than the Cardinals, but it was breathtaking to watch at the end.
Texas, in that Game 6 that you mentioned, came within one strike of winning their first World Series title in franchise history twice. Will the team's failure in Game 6 and then in Game 7, which they also led 2-0, rank as one of the worst postseason collapses of all time?
It has to, Bill. I know I've never seen anything like it. It was worse, believe it or not, than the 86 collapse by the Red Sox when they lost Game 6 in the Buckner game and then lost Game 7 also. No team had ever been two runs ahead in the ninth inning of a postseason game and then been two runs ahead in extra innings of the same game and not won the game. That's what the Rangers did. It was arguably the worst postseason loss in World Series history. In the end, they lost the terrible game, and it must have carried over to some degree into Game 7.
Tim, does the fact that the Cardinals won this thing cause you to reevaluate your methods of prediction? Because, oh boy, could I pull out the tape.
Bill, I'm no longer predicting anything. You understand? I'm done. I'm out of the prediction business, especially after this postseason. I don't think it got anything right in this postseason. I think I was wrong on every single one. It was unbelievable. Again, there's simply no way the Cardinals should have beaten the Phillies, and yet they did. And the Cardinals shouldn't even have beaten the Rangers, given where the Rangers were, where the Cardinals were. But this is the best part about the game. The unpredictable nature of the game is what I love so much. Every time you show up to watch it, something might happen that you've never seen before, and that happened through this entire postseason, and more than ever in Game 6. I have never in my life seen anything quite like Game 6 of the World Series.
Well, I agree with you, and I mean, infield pop-ups dropping, guys throwing the ball into the outfield or the dugout. Were you delighted by the fact that Game 7 wasn't as zany as Game 6?
Well, I knew Game 7, no way it could touch Game 6 as far as wildness, craziness, whatever you want to call it. No World Series game has ever had that level of drama and that it went from one of the worst games I've ever seen to one of the best games I've ever seen, and it happened in the same game. It was just the most remarkable thing. It wasn't the greatest World Series game ever played. It couldn't have been because it was so poorly played for five innings. But when it came to just being amazing, remarkable, incredible, whatever you want to call it, I've never seen a game like that. And Bill, I'm really old. I'm 54 years old. I've seen every World Series game for the last 31 years, and I've never seen that. The 623rd World Series game in history has never been played quite like that, and we'll go 623 more before we see another game like that, I promise you.
The Cardinals, meanwhile, may not enter the 2012 season as currently constituted. What happens in the offseason?
Well, they have to try to re-sign Albert Pujols, who, of course, is the premium free agent out there. And I think they're going to re-sign him one way or another for this reason. They won the World Series. He's a great team guy. He loves St. Louis. St. Louis loves him. And most important, I don't see the Red Sox or the Yankees, the two biggest bidders, being out there and making a run at Albert Pujols. I don't see the Cubs having enough money. I don't see the Angels or the Rangers or anyone else having enough money to get him. And I think one way or another, he's going back to St. Louis for an awful lot of money. He could have gotten more on a real open market, but I don't think it's as open as he would like it to be. And I think in the end, it's going to have a happy ending for Pujols and the Cardinals, and they'll be teammates again.
The Rangers, of course, have become a contender on Nolan Ryan's watch, but they've lost the World Series 2 years in a row. Will they continue to be in the postseason mix going forward?
I think so, Bill. They have a really good young nucleus of players there. But what they do every year, and you have to credit them with this, is they revamp and they find their weak spots and they fill them in no matter how much money it takes. So they may go get Prince Fielder, let's say, as a free agent. They may sign, I'm sure they will, a big-time pitcher or trade for one in the offseason because I think they're going to lose C.J. Wilson to free agency. But this is one of the beauties of the Rangers now is they're a very aggressive organization. And when they need something, they go get it now. And they're going to need something else because this loss was so devastating. They're going to look at it and say, what are we missing? And whatever it is, we got to go fill it because we're not going to let this happen, not again.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN, and he joined me on the line from St. Louis. Tim, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bill.
While fans of the Cardinals and the Rangers have been agonizing over dropped fly balls, bad throws, and leads that mysteriously evaporated, fans of the Houston Astros have been worrying about how their ball club might move without moving. Drayton McClain wants to sell the Houston Astros, Jim Crane wants to buy them, and Commissioner Bud Selig wants the team to switch leagues. Mickey Marvins heads an organization of fans called Save Our Stros, which has been trying to prevent the latter development by means of petitions, billboards, and internet chat. In her home full of Astros banners, tickets, and signed memorabilia, Mickey Marvins explains why she wants Houston to remain a National League city.
The history is there, and baseball is a game of tradition, and you just don't uproot an organization and move it to a different league. And they play by different rules. They have a designated hitter, which I'm not for. In the American League, there's no strategy.
The commissioner's reasoning is that the move would give each league 15 clubs, creating the balance necessary to expand the playoffs to include two more wildcard teams. But some Houston fans, Mickey Marvins included, feel the commissioner is paying insufficient attention to who's been attending Astros games.
When we played the Phillies, the Cardinals, the Cubs, the Mets, we were surrounded by their fans. They came in their shirts. They rooted for them. It seemed like there were more of them than us. They won't be able to see those teams anymore.
Richard Justice, who covers the Astros for the Houston Chronicle, understands the dismay of fans like Mickey Marvin's.
Houston fans are comfortable with the National League. They see the Reds and the Cubs and the Cardinals as their rivals, and they don't want to change.
Those sound like sentimental objections, but in part, as Marvin suggests, they are based on a love of the game as it's only played in the National League, without the designated hitter. Though Justice sees their point, he's inclined to think National League fans, and not just those in Houston, enjoy exaggerating the distinction between the two leagues for effect.
They see it as more strategy involved, more thinking by the manager. I once had a National League general manager watch an American League game and said, hey, you got to be brain dead to watch this game. Now, speaking as someone who covered the Baltimore Orioles for a decade, I didn't know I was covering a version of the sport that was flawed in any way.
Sentiment and rage against the DH aside, according to Rob Nyer, national baseball editor for SB Nation, the shift would create some challenges for Astros fans who like to watch road games and still get plenty of sleep.
You would have more games two time zones away. I mean, that's why the Astros are likely going to get some money in this deal. They're going to get some financial relief because it will hurt their TV ratings a little bit because they will suddenly be in the American League West, presumably, and have a lot more road games that start at 9:05 Houston time.
The sentimental argument for the shift is that Houston would gain a new natural rival, the Texas Rangers. Rob Nyer is among those who believe in the chemistry that matchup would generate.
I do think that in the long term, the fans will embrace that rivalry. They're not doing it yet. Most Astros fans seem to be pretty unexcited about the prospect of a move to the American League. But I think 5, 10, 20 years down the road, and you have to think about these things in the long term, I think it'll be a great rivalry.
Rangers owner Nolan Ryan has endorsed that notion, and he's an icon in Texas. Still, lots of Astros fans would feel betrayed were their team to change leagues, even though a shift in the opposite direction from the American to the National League after the 97 season served the Milwaukee Brewers reasonably well. They've been to the playoffs twice since replacing one set of rivals with another. Still, some Astros fans, Mickey Marvin's for one, can sound downright alarmist when speculating about Commissioner Selig's choice of teams to uproot.
We're absolutely petrified that they're going to mess up the Astros, cause them to not be successful, and then end up being moved to another city.
Those objections, heartfelt as they may be, are not likely to change the commissioner's plan. Mr. Selig is said to have made accepting the move a precondition to acquiring the Astros, and it's the fact that the team is changing hands that has given the commissioner the juice to change the lineup, at least according to Rob Nyer.
Hey, look, the reason it's happening to the Astros and not the Diamondbacks is because MLB has leverage because the Astros are being sold. If the Diamondbacks were being sold right now, they might be the ones moving. Somebody's got to move. If they're going to go to the better format, which is 15 teams in each league, somebody's got to move. And it just so happens that because the Astros are being sold, they're the ones.
Houston fans unhappy with that reality are likely to have at least another summer to watch a home team without the DH. The plan seems to be to shift the Astros into the American League for the 2013 season, which might also be the season in which we see an additional wild card team in each league. It's 19 minutes past the hour. New Zealand emerged triumphant in the recently completed Rugby World Cup, beating France in the final 8-7. Among those unsurprised by the result was Sonny Wool. That would be a fine name for a bookmaker, but Sonny Wool is an even better name for a sheep, and that's what he is, a psychic sheep at that. Sonny Wool picked New Zealand in a special ceremony at New Zealand's parliament. The sheep made his pick by ignoring a container of food that had been set beside the French flag and heading for the grub next to New Zealand's banner. Since Sonny Wool's owner said that whether the sheep would become mutton would depend in part on how the final came out, we can assume that Sonny Wool will live to bleat another day.
Go to hell.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a prediction that one NFL team will defy the laws of mathematics and lose 17 games in a 16-game season. But first, it was a week of change for college sports. On Thursday, the NCAA's Division I Board of Directors approved a provision that would allow schools to provide athletes with up to $2,000 in spending money, citing the need to ensure scholarships matched, quote, the full cost of attendance. The board also approved tougher academic standards for recruits. Meanwhile, rules aren't the only thing changing in college sports. Schools are changing conferences. The University of Missouri is expected to soon announce that it will leave the Big 12 and join the SEC, which will set off a series of other moves that are like a jigsaw puzzle, a game of dominoes, and a U.S. geography quiz all rolled into one. Only Game's Doug Tribou reports.
The University of Missouri is in the Midwest, but for the past few weeks, university presidents, athletic conference officials, TV executives, U.S. senators, and college football fans from the South, North, West, and East have had their eyes on the Tigers. How did they end up in the catbird seat? This fall, Texas A&M left the Big 12 for the Southeastern Conference. That gave the SEC an uneven 13 members, which can cause scheduling difficulties. Enter Missouri. The SEC prematurely welcomed the Tigers in a post on its website Thursday night, but quickly pulled the piece, saying there was no agreement. The Big 12 got tired of waiting, and on Friday extended an invitation to West Virginia. The Mountaineers gladly accepted. Fellow Big East member Louisville had been vying for the slot, too. In fact, the Big 12 opening was so desirable that, as Pete Thamel first reported in the New York Times, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky contacted officials at two Big 12 schools to lobby for Louisville's admission.
How much influence Mitch McConnell had in slowing down this West Virginia train and giving Louisville a shot, I don't know. I don't know if we'll ever know. But we do know he did have influence, and he did make calls. And people in West Virginia are irate.
Late last week, with the college football world watching, Missouri officials held a press conference. They essentially announced that they didn't have a big announcement. But Board of Curators Chairman Warren Erdman's remarks, broadcast on KOMU-TV, revealed a lot about the decision-making process.
As anxious as everyone, including our rabid fan base, is to have a definitive answer, we have to exercise our fiduciary duty. And we are taking our time to analyze all of the issues and to exercise that fiduciary duty on behalf of our university.
It's no coincidence that Erdman mentions fiduciary duty twice. Pete Thamel says Missouri and every other school considering a move are driven by the same thing.
The one constant factor here is money. Other than that, there's been a lot of different reasons, agendas, but at the end of the day, these school presidents are chasing the almighty dollar. And as the market has continued to grow and schools have tried to look out for their own best interest, it's created this whole chaotic landscape.
In July, the Pacific 10 Conference, or Pac-10, became the Pac-12 shortly after adding the universities of Colorado and Utah. How the teams will affect the athletic competition remains to be seen, but their impact on the Pac-12's finances was almost immediate. The conference brokered a new 12-year television agreement with Fox and ESPN worth a total of $3 billion, yes, billion dollars. Neil Pilson spent nearly two decades with CBS Sports, twice serving as president. Today he heads Pilson Communications, a sports television consulting firm.
It isn't so much the amount of television money. It is the security of television money. What's happening now is that deals are being made for a much longer term than in the past. 20 years ago, a long-term deal might be 3 to 5 years. Now we're talking about 8, 10, 12, even 14-year deals.
Pilson says college football also provides a low-risk, high-reward investment for television networks.
Not only is it stable and safe, it's growing. College football today and projected 10, 20, 30 years down the road is a very secure franchise.
You might be saying, okay, enough about money. What about rivalries? John Wilner, a college sports writer for the San Jose Mercury News, says some key matchups could be lost in the shuffle.
In most cases, it seems like the big rivalries are going to stay together, but certainly the situation with Texas and Texas A&M, that's a century-old rivalry or more, and that is very much in jeopardy.
West Virginia versus Pittsburgh is another rivalry that dates back more than 100 years. The Panthers have already agreed to leave the Big East for the Atlantic Coast Conference. With the Mountaineers off to the Big 12, the game known as the Backyard Brawl could be discontinued unless it's scheduled as a non-conference matchup. Okay, you say, new rivalries can develop, but what about geography? With Syracuse and Pitt already headed for the ACC, the Big East is considering the addition of Mountain West members Air Force and Boise State, and not exactly Eastern programs, including Brigham Young University, the University of Houston, and Southern Methodist University. CBSSports.com senior writer Brett McMurphy believes stretching the conferences beyond their traditional borders will hurt the product.
Is it really worth traveling across the country every other week to be in a football league? I think 5 or 10 years from now, we'll look back on this period of time and think, what in the world happened to college athletics? And more specifically, how cool it was when schools actually were competing against teams in neighboring states and didn't fly all over the country. I mean, basically, they're turning into a version of the NFL.
At this point, you might find yourself wondering, what about basketball? McMurphy says conference realignment affects basketball, but as Kansas learned, the moves are all about football.
When it appeared that the Big 12 was going to implode and the schools were going to leave for the Pac-12, Kansas was one of the schools that was left without a conference home. Kansas has arguably the greatest basketball tradition in history in the country, yet no conference wanted them.
And one key difference between football and basketball is money. Universities can negotiate their own agreements and profit directly from TV and bowl game contracts. And there are 6 conferences guaranteed a bowl championship series bid, which ups their value to TV networks and makes them more attractive to universities. But in basketball, the NCAA collects the TV money from March Madness and distributes it to the schools. And the impact of conference realignment extends well beyond the gridiron and the hardwood. Athletes in other sports like track and field may not generate big revenues, but they're affected. Again, John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News.
Just because a change in conference is good for the football program doesn't mean it's good for all the Olympic sports. But the schools believe that in order to pay for scholarships for the Olympic sports, pay for competitive coaching salaries in the Olympic sports, they have got to chase the football money. So that's what is driving everything.
And it's not like change is something new for major college sports. Conferences come and go, tournaments expand, bowl games get longer and funnier names. A complex formula decides who plays for the national championship. But one thing is constant. Students and alums will be rooting for their alma maters in any conference. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribune.
Amidst the end of a wild MLB postseason, a roller coaster week of NBA labor negotiations, and sweeping NCAA changes, many sports fans may have forgotten about a humble league that calls itself the NFL. Here to get us up to date on all the happenings on the professional gridiron is Greg Doyle of CBS Sports. Greg, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
There is exactly one undefeated NFL team going into Week 8 of the season. The Green Bay Packers are 7-0. Do you think they'll become the second team to go lossless since 1978 when the league expanded the regular season to 16 games?
No, because I think Murky Morris has a witch doctor in Haiti that puts a hex on everybody that even comes close to it, and the Packers aren't good enough to overcome that hex. But they're really good. They won the Super Bowl last year, and they're better. And they're not just a little bit better. They're clearly better. This Packers team beats last year's Packers team by 10. But nobody goes 16-0. It's just not going to happen, and it won't happen this year. And not because I can tell you why. I don't have an intellectual reason why. It doesn't happen and won't happen.
Greg, it looked early on as if Detroit might be capable of running the table this season, but they've lost their last 2 games. What's happened to the Lions?
Well, the same thing that's going to happen to the Packers at some point. They're going to lose a game because you just don't win them all. The Lions are still very good. They were 5-0, and they lost a close game to San Francisco. And the 49ers are one of those teams that aren't very good, but they're tougher than you. Their coach is probably smarter than you. And when the game ends, they're going to have more points than you, and no one's going to understand why. It's like when Greg Maddux used to pitch for the Braves. Batters would tell you that they'd have an 0-for-4 game, and they felt like they had a good game. They looked at the box score, oh, I went 0-for-4. I thought I did so well. The 49ers are that team. You know, you play them, and you're better than them. At the end of the game, for some reason, they have more points than you. And then last week, they lost to Atlanta. Atlanta's very good. There's just no shame in those losses, and I think the Lions will still win 12 this year and go to the playoffs.
5-1 San Francisco has been something of a surprise this season. They must have some really good players, but I think their success stems from that big high school kid they've apparently hired to be the head coach. Are the parents of Jim Harbaugh concerned the Niners may be breaking California's labor laws?
Yeah, what a big oaf he is. And I kind of like him, but I like him in that big oaf way that you like a St. Bernard that knocks you down at the door and you just want to – that's how I like Jim Harbaugh, because he's just a clod. I mean, he's the guy that – they beat the Lions. The Lions are 5-0. He beats the Lions, shakes hands with the coach so hard, knocks him on – claps him on the back like a drunken frat boy. Claps him on the back, knocks him over, and almost causes a post-game melee because he's just that big of a clod. But he's very inspirational. I'm guessing he knows X's and O's at a great high level. I don't know him enough to know how good his X's and O's are. I just know that his team plays hard, plays smart, plays tough. Basically, he's a much better-looking Bill Cowher.
St. Louis and Miami are currently 0-6, so they would share the worst record in the NFL if Indianapolis hadn't played one more game than they have. The Colts are 0-7. Their bye week doesn't happen until November 20th. Do you suppose the players have that date circled on their calendars?
Yeah, they're going to lose that one, too. The Indianapolis Colts, that team, like the Dolphins and Rams are so bad, I can see them going 0-16. The Colts are so bad, they're going to go 0-17 this year. They're terrible. And poor Andrew Luck, he's only a junior. You know, he's been the number one overall draft pick for about 8 years. He's like the Tim Duncan of college football. He's been the number one pick for about 9 years. He's going to go back to college next year if that means not playing for the Colts. I can assure you of that.
Is the Colts' horrendous 2011 start proof of the injured Peyton Manning's MVP caliber, or would the team be just as bad if he were playing?
It's the same group of guys that wins 10 or 11 games every year and goes to the playoffs every year. Same defensive stars, same running back, same receivers, same tight end. Yeah, they've had a couple injury issues, but the Colts always do. Everybody does. But the difference is that Peyton Manning's back there throwing the ball. He's that good. And Tony Dungy was also very good. Now, if Dungy was their coach right now, they might still be 0-7, but they wouldn't be 0-7 coming off a 62-7 loss to the Saints. Jim Caldwell's not very good. They went to the Super Bowl with Jim Caldwell, fine. They went to the Super Bowl with Peyton Manning, okay? Caldwell just was the guy on the sideline. He was a Wake Forest. He's not that good. The Colts are embodying the idea that, yes, a guy who doesn't take a snap this year should at least get votes in the MVP balloting.
Monday Night Football is still a huge deal, at least judging from the ratings and the TV money involved. But the 2011 matchups have so far been so lackluster. And as I glance at the schedule, I notice this gem, Indianapolis v. Tampa Bay on December 12th. Can't the league and the network do any better than that?
Yeah, I thought flex scheduling meant they had flexibility, but I guess Monday Night Football, there is no flexibility. You overlooked the fact that we got the Chargers playing the Chiefs just coming up this Monday. It's bad, and it's only going to get worse. They ought to just do what the NBA does. The NBA says, basically, if we're putting a game on TV, LeBron James is playing in it. The NFL ought to do the same thing. If we're going to put a game on TV, Aaron Rodgers, you're the quarterback. I don't even care if we put the Bengals and the Bills. We're going to fly Aaron Rodgers in. He's going to play all-time offense, Aaron Rodgers.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins Only a Game from time to time to talk pro football. Thanks again, Greg.
Oh, thank you for having me, Bill.
You're listening to Only a Game. Jim Mueller left a message on our Facebook page this week. I can't believe that with all of the articles and interviews released in the wake of IndyCar driver Dan Weldon's death, you turned to the Wall Street Journal for your motorsports expert, he began. I'm not sure what Alexandra Berzon's background is, but it evidently is not in motorsports. In her article, she comes very close to claiming that IndyCar CEO Randy Bernard was promoting death and destruction if fans attended the race. Anybody who knows anything about the racing fraternity knows it's a racing family. Richard Weiss, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, was similarly dismayed. You did not point out that the immediate cause of Dan Weldon's death was his car being catapulted into the catch fence by running over the rear wheels of another car, he wrote. Mr. Wise pointed out that engineers have modified the rear ends of the cars that will be on the track in 2012, which he feels, quote, makes Dan Weldon's death even sadder. Mr. Wise went on to say, I'll be the first to say that high-speed oval racing is pretty pointless, but painting the situation as worse than it already is does not serve anyone. Charlie Pierce was among many analysts who didn't think we'd be seeing the St. Louis Cardinals in action last night. Bill Howells, who hears the program on KWMU in St. Louis, remembers that. Ha-ha, Charlie Pierce, he wrote, eat your hat. Bill, could you please play that clip of Charlie saying the Cardinals would never beat the Phillies and insert some munching sounds afterwards? I want to imagine Charlie eating his hat. Munch, munch, munch. Normally, I'd now read an email from somebody who considers Only a Game brilliant appointment listening, but I will turn instead to some correspondence from Dave Pearson, who's becoming something of a regular. He sent along an article about a recent cricket match, which was interrupted when a small meteor crashed onto the pitch. Happily, nobody was injured. The story ends with a meteorite expert from Imperial College in London suggesting that the object, quote, may contain secrets as to the formation of our solar system. Perhaps it will also reveal how the Cardinals managed to continue playing baseball until the end of October. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
The Kadam train station near Damascus was recently the site of an exceptional feat of strength. A Syrian gentleman named Adnan Ismail al-Awad strapped himself into a harness which had been attached to the front of a train packed with passengers. Mr. al-Awad claimed that because the train was on an uphill grade, it weighed the equivalent of 100 tons, and who was going to argue with him? Having taken, one assumes, a very deep breath, Mr. al-Awad gave a hearty tug and pulled the train several feet along the track. An observer named Mohammed Youssef pointed out that, quote, this needs great strength. Yes, Mr. Youssef, that is so.
Big train. Big train. Train.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, not all sweetness and yards gained. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
NCAA President Mark Emmert proposed that conferences should be allowed to offer a $2,000 increase in grants to student-athletes to cover the, quote, full cost of attendance, and the NCAA Board of Directors voted aye on Thursday. So that should end all the talk about how a billion-dollar industry that doesn't pay its workers shouldn't be tolerated, right?
Yes, because they're being quite clear that the $2,000, quote, full cost of attendance is not pay for play.
No.
Of course not. It's available to every student on campus. Once again, the NCAA is delaying the inevitable and doing a really bad job of it by throwing up, you know, essentially paper walls of euphemism against you know, what everybody, every thinking human being in the world knows it's going to have to do eventually.
Paper walls of euphemism. I'm going to have to scribble that down.
I think that was a King Crimson album. I think I stole that from them.
Well, it should be the name of a rock band. The NCAA also approves stricter academic standards for teams that would like to participate in the postseason. Do you think they knew ahead of time that the new rules would knock perennial contender UConn out of the 2013 men's basketball tournament?
I almost glibly answered no, but then I'm beginning to think, you know, if they really wanted to make a point, this would be a really good way to do it. You have to have a two-year average score of 930 or a four-year average of 900 on the NCAA's annual academic progress rate, which I don't even want to begin to estimate the math on. And Connecticut's, alas, scored an 826 for the 2009-2010 school year.
The excitement of a seventh game notwithstanding, the numbers suggest that a relatively small number of people watched the World Series on television. Should Major League Baseball be worried?
I don't think so. I think we are at a historic low point for television ratings for all sports, but I would point out that the two games over the weekend, which were paired up against really awful football games elsewhere, a 12-7 Jacksonville Jaguars win over Baltimore, and New Orleans beating Indianapolis 62-7, the World Series game won both of those head-to-heads. Anytime baseball beats football in a head-to-head at this time of year is a significant event. So, no, I don't think baseball should be that worried.
Personally, I think baseball should be worried when a third baseman on a team in the World Series can't catch a pop-up.
How about when a right fielder decides to take the circuit route through Arkansas to get to the game-ending, the World Series-ending fly ball?
It's a somewhat dated story now, of course, since the series is over, but can you explain to me how in Game 5 of the World Series in 2011, when even the Bat Boys have smartphones, the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals can't successfully get the right pitchers up in the bullpen?
Yeah, apparently things were a little bit too loud and nobody could hear anybody and the wrong pitcher. Came in to pitch against Mike Napoli and resulted in a two-run double that won the game for Texas. I don't know. Perhaps it's better just to go to Semaphore or something in situations like that. I would pay a lot of money to see Tony La Russa with those little flags. He'd blow his rotator cuff by the third inning.
Elsewhere in baseball news, Theo Epstein has finally joined the Chicago Cubs as president of baseball operations. His old pal and former colleague with the Red Sox, Jed Hoyer, has left the San Diego Padres to join Epstein, becoming GM in Chicago. So, how long before the Cubs win everything for the first time since 1908?
Well, 2 years, right? I mean, that's Theo's track
record.
Okay, the one thing he will do, and he's already begun to do it by bringing in Jed Hoyer, he will build a terrific front office staff out there. The Chicago Cubs' comedy of errors in terms of player acquisition, those days are at an end right now.
All right, let's see. Your name is Frank McCourt.
No, it's not. Here's a buck.
You're in a bitter court battle with your ex-wife. Major League Baseball is accusing you of, quote, looting nearly $190 million from the L.A. Dodgers. How could you possibly further diminish your reputation?
You go after the guy in the coma. That's what you do. Brian Stowe was the guy who got beaten into a coma outside a Dodgers game and is now suing the Dodgers for failing to keep a civil environment where you wouldn't get beaten into a coma at one of their baseball games because he still happened to be wearing some San Francisco Giants gear. The Dodgers are now saying he shares the blame for being beaten up. This is going to be their defense in court. This is going to be one of those things where if you happen to be like one of the Dodgers lawyers, you immediately, when the case is adjudged one way or the other, you immediately leave, get drunk for 5 days, and join a monastery because you've plainly wasted your life.
It's without a question. In an attempt to facilitate his return to the National Football League, Terrell Owens staged a televised workout and invited the scouts to Calabasas High School for that workout. And how'd that workout work out?
He's been offered a contract by the AFL. No, it's not 1961, and we're not talking about the Denver Broncos or the Houston Oilers. We're not talking about
the old Patriots.
We're not talking about sending him to Balboa Stadium or Jeppesen Stadium or any of those other places. We're talking about arena ball, ladies and gentlemen. The human video game that everybody loves. So, yes, he's got a chance in football. It's just not real football.
I've heard you can make $400 a week. Meanwhile, Reggie Bush is not making many new friends in Miami. After the Dolphins lost their sixth game of the season last week, Bush said, and I'm quoting, "This team stinks. His teammates are not pleased." What? Does an 0-6 record deserve to be characterized any other way?
I refer you to libel law. Truth is an absolute defense. You guys do stink. Don't get mad at Reggie Bush. Stop stinking.
With a terse but not unexpected announcement on Wednesday, women's pro soccer let us all know that the franchise known as Magic Jack will play no more. Do you suppose Abby Wambach and Hope Solo will catch on with another team somewhere?
I don't suspect they'll have a problem, but I think Dan Borislow, the obstreperous owner who has insulted virtually everybody, including you.
he called me a dumbass.
I know that. He can't do that to you. Only I can do that to you. He's filed suit against the Women's Professional Soccer League in a Florida court, and the league, meanwhile, released a statement accusing him of violations ranging from unprofessional and disparaging treatment of his players to failure to pay his bills, and nothing in there about disparaging treatment of NPR sports hosts.
I understand that anybody who's still looking for a Halloween costume and might long to pretend to be an NFL player is in luck, Charlie.
You can get a pair of Tim Tebow's game-worn pants from last year's game against the Kansas City Chiefs. They're on eBay for a penny below $5,000. Yes, friends, you can get into Tim Tebow's pants.
I can see that coming from around the corner, around the block, in another town altogether.
Another time zone! A joke beyond the event horizon.
Charlie Pierce blogs about politics for Esquire magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
That Walter Payton, nicknamed Sweetness, would be voted into the Football Hall of Fame was never in doubt. He broke the NFL career rushing record that had been established by Cleveland Browns great Jim Brown, was named MVP twice, appeared in 9 Pro Bowls, and played on the Bears team that won the Super Bowl in 1986. Payton, who died in 1999, seemed to be an upbeat fellow. He participated in charitable events and, even as he was dying, encouraged everyone he could reach to consider organ donation. That's no doubt how he would be remembered were it not for a new book titled Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton. Jeff Perlman is the author of that book, and he joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you. I hope you still remember that way, actually.
I'm sure you do.
I really do.
Before we get into the particulars of the book, NFL.com rates Walter Payton as the 5th best player of all time. Have they got that about right?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, you can argue, you know, anywhere from 1 to 10. The thing that I think gets lost is when people talk about the all-time great athletes in the NFL, they never mention Walter Payton. They mention Willie Gault, Deion Sanders, Herschel Walker, guys like that. And Payton was just this insane athlete. He could walk 100 yards on his hands. He was about 5'9 and a half. He could dunk from standing under a hoop. He could hit a golf ball a mile. He could throw a football 70 yards. He had the softest hands. He was an insanely gifted blocker. He just could do absolutely everything. So I think definitely one of the top 5 NFL players of all time, but also one of the probably top 20 athletes to ever play the game.
You mentioned several times, and I'm quoting now, the insecurity that often accompanies greatness. I've heard that phrase applied to Mickey Mantle, among others, but what accounted for the insecurity in Walter Payton's case?
You know, I actually think, to be honest, I think it started at Jackson State, and it's a small, you know, at the time, Division II college. Nobody pays it much mind, and he's watching Archie Griffin of Ohio State. He's watching Anthony Davis of USC, Steve Barkowski at Cal. And seeing all these guys get talked about for the Heisman Trophy. And here's Walter Payton, this just insanely gifted athlete. But he's running over teams like Bishop College, you know, and Alcorn State. And nobody's paying him much mind. And as his career progressed and he made it to the NFL, whether it was, you know, Billy Sims or Otis Anderson or Eric Dickerson or Marcus Allen, he'd always look at other guys and ask his teammates, do you think that guy's better than me? Do you think that guy's better than me? I mean, the day his last game after 13 years and he's in the locker room changing, and someone says, hey, Walter, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, 13 damn years, and they still don't call me Mr. Payton.
Hmm. You spoke with many of Walter Payton's former teammates, some of whom regarded his behavior as, I'm quoting again, strange. What were they referring to particularly?
Well, there were a couple of things. Number one, he had a very off-putting sense of humor, very off-putting. He was a guy who would throw, like, you know, his balled-up, sweaty socks at your head and think it was really funny. And guys, you know, put up with it, but never loved it. And the other thing, he had a very high-pitched voice, a falsetto, and he called a teammate up on Thanksgiving, and the wife answered the phone, And he goes in his high-pitched voice, he goes, "Hi, is Thomas there?" And she goes, "Who's this?" And she says, "Well, this is, this is Veronica. Can you just tell him? Just tell him that the baby needs shoes. If he can call me, I need that money for the baby's shoes." He did this great women's voice, much better than mine. And the guy comes back, the football player comes back, and Thanksgiving dinner hasn't been cooked. All his stuff is thrown outside. And he's like, "What's going on here?" And she's like, "Who's Veronica?" And blah, blah, blah. And he did this countless times to teammates and oftentimes with success. He used his high-pitched voice in very, very mischievous ways.
Walter Payton and the people who worked with him were very conscious of his image. Describe the version of Payton that he and his wife and associates created while he was alive and that was sustained after his death, and tell me whether you considered that image valid before you undertook the project.
Well, I can answer that. I certainly did. And first and foremost was this sort of, I would say, family man. You know, happy marriage, me and Connie and me, et cetera, Connie in the front row of the Hall of Fame, Connie doing commercials with him, you know, and he actually didn't live with his wife for the last 10 years of his life. They were separated, but they sort of maintained this kind of image of the happy Mr. and Mrs. Walter Payton. And Bear fans loved him and should have loved him because he signed every autograph. You could interrupt him at dinner. He would sign every autograph. Michael Jordan and Walter Payton are sort of the, and maybe Ernie Banks are sort of the, that's the big holy trinity of Chicago icons. And the difference between Jordan and Payton is Jordan was certainly a better player in the history of sports, but Walter Payton was 10,000 times more touchable and reachable by the fans, and that makes him beloved. They tried to paint this sort of picture of happy-go-lucky Walter Payton, and he was a sort of iffy businessman. His family life was in shambles. Physically, he was in a lot of pain and using a lot of painkillers, and everyone expects this thing of you. Everyone expects this sweetness, this image of you. Your sweetness, he's sweetness, this guy's sweetness. Everyone wants autographs and smiles, and they don't want to know the sort of the hurt that's going on. And he was really, really, really hurting.
Beyond the depression, I gather there were serial infidelities and one illegitimate child that Payton chose not to acknowledge.
It's funny, when you write a biography and you spend 3 years working on it, you really get into someone. And there are certain things when you find out you don't especially want to know. I'm going along writing this book about Walter Payton, sort of loving him, and there's this one inexplicable. I can understand, obviously, the depression and the failed marriage, et cetera, et cetera. But he had an out-of-wedlock son who was born a couple of months before his daughter was born. He never lived very far from the kid and never showed any interest. He took financial care, but never showed any interest. And in fact, one of his friends told me a story. One time on a lark, she took him to a palm reader, Walter Payton, and the woman holds Walter Payton's palms. And she says, "I see that you have three children." And he pulls his arms away and walks out. I think if you want to talk about things that haunted him, that he sort of didn't know how to deal with. He was very good at compartmentalizing things. But I think it definitely sort of weighed on him that he knew there was a child out there who was his, who he had nothing to do with.
Given what we now know about chronic traumatic encephalopathy, do you think multiple concussions, diagnosed or not, might account for some of Payton's bizarre behavior?
I mean, it's certainly possible. And, you know, Connie, his widow, I saw her in an interview recently say that she wished, or, it's something to think about. And I agree with that. The problem is, and I actually got criticized, one of the criticisms I got for the book was, how could you not delve into this? And the reason I didn't delve into it is because he died in 1999. He was immediately cremated after he died, and there are no studies done whatsoever. So is it possible? It's certainly possible. I do think what I know for sure, though, is that he really battled severe depression related, at least in some part, to sort of the aimlessness and helplessness of being an ex-athlete.
Mike Ditka, who coached the Bears during part of Walter Payton's career, has said that he's prepared to spit on you for writing about Payton's infidelities, his drug use, suicide threats, and so on. What do you make of objections like that to the book?
Well, first of all, I now carry around, actually, NPR was very gracious and gave me a paper cup that I'm holding in front of me. So now, if Mike Ditka spits on me, I will take this paper cup, wipe the spit off the paper cup, put a lid on it, and sell it on eBay to the highest Chicago bidder. And I will even throw in a copy of my book for free with the spit on it if you want. You know what? To be honest with you, Ditka actually was pretty contrite a couple of days later. He appeared on a show in Miami, and they played some comments I made in reaction to it where I said, you know, here's this guy who, Mike Ditka, who's devoted a lot of energy and a lot of time in a very good way to sort of helping retired players deal with problems that Walter Payton was going through. And he's angry that these problems are being talked about. I thought that was ridiculous. And when he heard that, he said, yeah, you know, maybe the guy has a point. What I found frustrating with this book, this is my fifth book, and this is the first time I've had this, is Sports Illustrated ran an excerpt dealing specifically with Walter's final sort of years of life. And everyone decided that I wrote a book to destroy Walter Payton. Some of the writers wrote things in the Chicago newspapers I just couldn't believe because I hadn't read the book yet. And that's what's frustrating. I keep saying, please read the book. I don't care if you take it out from your library. Read the book and you'll see this is a definitive biography of a fascinating man's life. And part of his life were these troubles. But that's not the man's life as a whole. There was so much more to him. And I just keep saying to people, read the book and you will see, I think, a very fair and honest and accurate and sympathetic portrayal of Walter Payton.
Jeff Perlman is the author of Sweetness, The Enigmatic Life of Walter Payton. It's published by Gotham Books, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jillian Guybe. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo galleries or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from Sweetness author Jeff Perlman, who answers my question, why can't I get any of my books on NPR?
Maybe because they're not good. No, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
Okay,
just
forget
kidding.
It. Totally this is off. This is gone. Okay, laugh all you want, Mr. Sweetness biographer guy. You just wait until I write the Jeff Perlman biography, and it'll be good. Oh, it'll be real good, and it'll be on NPR. Don't you worry about that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And American Jewish World Service, supporting local solutions to global challenges at ajws.org. This is NPR.